The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
For all of the discussion of just how careful Kavanaugh is about deferring to Congress and taking statutes seriously, imagine if in 10 or 15 years, Democrats control both houses of Congress and the White House and are pushing aggressive legislation through that actually runs into some of Judge Kavanaugh's ideological and constitutional commitments. I don't think he's going to be shy at all, as he hasn't been in the, you know, appointments clause and removal context, of not deferring to Congress and the executive branch in those contexts. And so, you know, I don't think it's right to portray him as someone who generally defers to the political branch. I think it's better to portray him as someone who defers when he thinks courts have less of a role to play and national security is just about categorically an area where he thinks that's the appropriate way forward. And if that's going to be where the court is for the next 15, 20, 25 years, I think it puts a lot of pressure on the justice who I think would then become the median among the current court, and I think that's Chief Justice John Roberts, to try to sort of split the difference and not, you know, totally cut off a meaningful judicial role in the national security context. And that to me is going to be where, you know, the big fights are in the Supreme Court in national security litigation in the near future.
I'm Scott R. Anderson, and you're listening to the Lawfare podcast for July 24th, 2018. Justice Kennedy's resignation and the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh as his replacement promises to usher in a new era on the U.S. Supreme Court, not least in the areas of foreign relations and national security law that we focus on here at Lawfare. To hash out what these changes on the court may mean, I spoke to Jen Mascott of the Antonin Scalia School of Law at George Mason University, Steve Vladeck of the School of Law at the University of Texas at Austin, and former DOJ official Bob Loeb, currently a partner at the law firm Orrick, Harrington & Sutcliffe. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Episode 332. Kennedy, Kavanaugh, and the future of national security before the Supreme Court. At the end of this last Supreme Court term, we got the news that Justice Kennedy was resigning, which introduced a pretty major change to the court. Of course, over the course of his tenure, Justice Kennedy wrote a number of cases relating to national security, relating to foreign relations law. You think of Boumediene v. Bush, you think of Zivotofsky v. Kerry, just this last term, Jesner v. Arab Bank, about the Alien Tort Statute. Jen, let me turn to you first. What do these decisions tell us about the role that Kennedy has played on the court when it comes to these sorts of national security and foreign relations matters?
Well, I think, you know, with Justice Kennedy's role on the court with national security matters, I mean, obviously he's had expertise in the area. He's played a leading role. He tends to be across issue areas, somebody who tends to reach compromise and be able to reach across both sides of the aisle. And so that's been an important key role, obviously, that he's played in this area of the law as well as many others.
Absolutely. Steve, you made an interesting point on Twitter, I saw, where you compared what you described as Justice Kennedy's functional approach regarding particularly separations of powers cases, which, of course, is many national security cases, and comparing that to what you called the formalism of Judge Kavanaugh, who we're going to talk about a little bit more in a second. Can you drill down a little bit? What do you mean by the functional approach by which Justice Kennedy approached these sorts of issues? And do we see any other justices that may take up that approach on the court in his absence?
Sure. I mean, I think with regard to the functional approach, one of my favorite opinions by Justice Kennedy is his concurring opinion in a 1989 case called Public Citizen versus U.S. Department of Justice. And what he says in that opinion is where the Constitution is unambiguous, where the text is clear, obviously formalism is called for. That is to say, we should interpret the text as written. We should draw bright lines. We should assume that the branches are hermetically sealed from each other, but that there are plenty of circumstances where that's not true. And in those contexts, you know, he thinks functional considerations, what makes sense, what has the historical practice been, what would be the implications of, you know, the competing rules advanced by the parties, should factor at least to some degree in the court's decision making. And I think we see that a lot in some of his, you know, key national security cases. There's a fair amount of functionalism in Boumediene when he talks about why the unique nature of the U.S. government's control and sovereignty over Guantanamo militated in favor of finding that the suspension clause should apply there. We see it, I think, in Zivotofsky, even though he ends up ruling for the executive branch, he takes a sort of roundabout way to get there. And it's not just, you know, the Constitution says X, therefore we're done. And I think of the current justices, you know, if we see Judge Kavanaugh confirmed to Justice Kennedy's seat, we're really not going to see certainly a majority of functionalists in separation of powers cases. I think, you know, all four of the current remaining conservative justices are pretty formalistic in this space. Maybe there's a little bit of functionalism among the more progressive justices. Justice Breyer, for example, sometimes, you know, devolves into these considerations. But I think the key is, you know, Justice Kennedy was not just a functionalist. He was a functionalist in the middle. And whoever the fifth vote is going to be in separation of powers cases that divide the court 5-4, I think the odds that it's someone who is similarly functionalist, if Judge Kavanaugh is confirmed, is very, very slim.
And this is kind of just to expand a little bit on this, functionalism was kind of something that I recall people also used to describe Justice O'Connor a little bit when she sat more in that kind of middle swing seat. Is this something that we're going to see judges gravitate towards because it's a grounds on which to build consensus if you are that fifth vote? Or do you think there's really just a totally different take that most of these justices, the more formalist ones as you describe them, take?
I mean, I think this is the principal difference between the conservatism of an Anthony Kennedy and the conservatism of a Sandra Day O'Connor and the conservatism of a John Roberts and a Brett Kavanaugh. I mean, I don't think all of a sudden Chief Justice Roberts is going to find his functionalist tendencies because he might be the median. And so I think what we're going to see is more, you know, sharper lines being drawn in separation of powers cases, for better or for worse. And in the context of national security, I think, you know, especially the more formalistic the court is, the more likely it is to defer to the executive branch to, you know, sort of minimize the judicial role. And I think that's consistent with many of Judge Kavanaugh's opinions during his, you know, 12 years on the D.C. Circuit.
Well, if I can add and jump in, too, I think one other change maybe that we're seeing, and I definitely agree with Steve, that it seems likely that the court in Justice Kennedy's absence would not continue to be as functionalist. And I think if we can move even slightly further back, you know, with Justice Scalia, who's now obviously been gone from the court for several years, I think moving a larger number of justices, perhaps in a theoretically to a more formalist direction, is a real legacy of his. And so obviously, even though he's not still there, I think that legacy of his will continue. I think one way I might characterize things slightly differently from Steve is that I think that the formalist approach maybe sometimes leads to deferring to the executive, but also can lead to deferring to Congress as well, so the political branches more broadly. And then there also are times when I think more of the formalist approach maybe actually ends up leading to more rights rather than less. So one example that comes to mind perhaps would be in the Hamdi case, where Justice O'Connor wrote a pretty formalist opinion giving some due process rights, to challenge detention, but didn't go quite as far as Justice Scalia, who really in his formalism, you almost made it sound like made it sound like the detention was actually not appropriate in that case for a U.S. citizen at all, with absent the suspension of the writ of habeas corpus.
Well, so, you know, obviously Justice Kennedy departing from the court is a major moment, is going to introduce a lot of changes. But as of last Monday, it's no longer as big a question mark about who's going to take that ninth seat. Now, President Trump obviously announced who we already have mentioned, which is Judge Brett Kavanaugh, someone who's been talked about for a long time as potential Republican nominee to the court, as his nominee to replace Justice Kennedy. Now, Bob, you as a Department of Justice official during the Obama administration argued before Judge Kavanaugh in a number of cases, many of which related to national security. What's your sense from your practicing before him and arguing before him about how he tends to approach these sorts of cases and how that may affect his role as a justice?
So in contrast to Justice Kennedy, you had in some cases, a functional or practical type bent. Judge Kavanaugh has always been very thorough in articulating all the functional and practical concerns, but then always turns and says those are things which have to be addressed by the president or by Congress and not by the judges. He has a long track record now, I think 11 years on the D.C. Circuit, of viewing national security and foreign affairs matters as one for the political branches, for the executive and Congress. And if you look at his key opinions, reoccurring theme again and again is that we enforce the limits set by Congress and by the Constitution when they're clear, but we can't freelance based on things such as customary international law or otherwise. And he speaks in really strong terms, saying that we can't, you know, read our role greater than that spelled out. In the Michal case more recently, where he was addressing whether a U.S. citizen can sue in U.S. court regarding claims of abuse in Africa and conspiracy with the countries there. He said there was no right to sue because it involved a terrorism investigation and because it happened overseas. So there could be no remedy. And he said in big letters, this is all about who decides. And he says, in my view, it is Congress that decides, not the judiciary. And then he said in really striking language, it would be disrespectful to Congress and the president and would disregard our proper role of judges to provide a remedy. So a lot of times we talk about judges get up in the Senate and say, we're just calling balls and strikes. These are areas where there's a significant amount of gray, or in the Guantanamo cases, where the D.C. Circuit was really inventing large swaths of law and where Judge Kavanaugh had a lot of latitude to express his own views. And we see he has again and again shown deference to Congress and the president regarding matters of national security and foreign affairs.
Now, Jen, Bob's been spent a lot of time in front of Judge Kavanaugh, but you spent a fair amount of time with him on the other side of the bench, obviously as one of his law clerks earlier in his tenure as a judge. Does what Bob says ring true to you? What can you tell us about how he thinks about these cases, having borne witness to his reasoning process and how he approaches them from the inside?
Well, I certainly agree and read a lot of Judge Kavanaugh's opinions to be very focused on the appropriate role of Congress and the executive in foreign policy matters. And so I have a couple of additional thoughts. I mean, one is I do think that at the end of the day, though, as Bob said, Judge Kavanaugh is very thoughtful in his opinions. And so there was one opinion that I was reading recently of Judge Kavanaugh, actually, where he had the opportunity to invoke the political question doctrine in an area where there was a claim that Congress had wrongly regulated the role of the executive. And Judge Kavanaugh actually, though, in that case, almost surprisingly, you might think, based on his approach in other cases, said, no, here the political question doctrine actually wouldn't be appropriate because if the court doesn't step in, it's going to be a de facto ruling in favor of the executive. And so I definitely think he believes that, you know, in areas of statutory interpretation in particular, that the courts have a role. However, I do agree with Bob that from looking at Judge Kavanaugh's body of work, you know, he does see the structure of the Constitution as setting up Congress and the executive with kind of a foreign policy role. And I think, you know, some of the reasons that he's expressed for that are, you know, really get to the nature of our system of government and kind of and what is the role that the various branches are supposed to play. And so it's not necessarily favoring those branches over the courts, but this idea that Congress and the executive are going to be better equipped to handle issues of national security and foreign policy. Also, you know, the idea that sometimes if the courts step in, too much in an area where they end up being the decision maker or deciding which international law is supposed to apply rather than waiting for Congress to incorporate international principles into domestic law, that what ends up happening is you lose some of that electoral accountability that the American public's getting from the elected branches like Congress and the executive making decisions. So I think those are some of the things and constitutional understandings that are really undergirding a lot of Judge Kavanaugh's view or approach in these cases. And then the third thing I would say, though, also is it is a little bit hard to predict, you know, what would happen when a lower court judge is appointed, if he gets appointed to the next level, because obviously he is also bound by precedent. So I also see a lot of discussion in his opinions front and center of Supreme Court precedent and trying to figure out how the issues come down in light of major Supreme Court rulings in the area for each case. And so it could be that, you know, when he goes to the Supreme Court, that he's also feels free to be able to look even closer, more closely at the constitutional text and structure, not having that vertical stare decisis value as much of a role in his opinions any longer.
Well, let me disagree with that. At least on the national security and foreign affairs front, I think he has shown his own stripes very clearly in the Guantanamo case, again, where he was literally writing new law. But also in the Bahani case, we saw him deal with the Charming Betsy principle, which is a well-established principle that you construe federal statutes so they don't conflict with international law. And he went out of his way in the Bahani case writing some 70-page opus about his views of international law, which in a very strident way that, you know, that the judiciary does not have the proper role unless Congress has embraced international law and codified into statute or has codified into a self-executing treaty. It is impermissible, in his view, for a court to take into account, even with the Charming Betsy principle, which has been around for over 100 years. He marginalizes it, puts it in a corner, which you can do. And that's certainly a very legitimate view. And we were at the government. We argued that position to him. Make no mistake, it wasn't. He's not controlled by precedent. He's expressing his own distillation of the law. Let me give one other example of a Guantanamo case, which I think is telling of his role on these kind of cases, is the Razak Ali case, where when we argue these cases again and again before him, he would always on his own raise the question of, like, how long do you think you can detain these guys? Is this really lifetime detention? And he was always curious about that issue, even when it wasn't raised by the detainee. And so in Razak Ali, it was raised by the detainee, and he finally addresses it and does so at length. And he emphasizes, look, this is law of war detention under the AUMF. It's not about guilt. It's not about punishment. It's about the statute. And could it be lifetime detention? Well, you know, at this point, we don't know. That's a good point. And he goes on and explains why that's a very serious concern and why Congress might apply different standards or the president might want to apply different standards. But he says it would be wholly inappropriate for the courts on their own to apply a higher standard for detention of someone during the hostilities under the traditional law of war type situation without further direction from Congress. And again, he stops and says that is not the role of the judiciary. He punts it back to the political branches in Congress and the president and says, that's your role. Congress, you want to adopt a different standard, we will enforce it. The president said to Obama, I see you're actually applying a different standard in your own annual review. Good for you, but don't expect us to do it for you.
Well, and that's a great entree because Judge Kavanaugh is unique, certainly among a lot of the other nominees or candidates, excuse me, that were reportedly being considered by President Trump, and that he's a very, very long, long list of publications, not just as a judge in the form of his written opinions, but also articles and speeches and remarks he's made that give a lot of his views on a lot of these substantive issues. And I think it's worth digging into a few of them there. Bob, you already mentioned the Bahani case and his views about international law. I want to dig a little deeper on there. And Steve, I want to turn to you. I know you were on a panel with Judge Kavanaugh, I think in 2012, just a few years after Bahani came out, where you and a few other participants ended up pushing, engaging in dialogue with him a little bit on those views. What was your takeaway from Bahani and from that engagement and other decisions about how he thinks about these international law issues? Does it jibe well with Bob's summary? Are there other aspects we should be pulling out?
I mean, if anything, I think Bob didn't go far enough. I mean, I think one of the things that really comes through in Judge Kavanaugh's writings, especially in the Guantanamo cases, it's long been common among conservative judges to be skeptical of the role of international law. But some of the arguments Judge Kavanaugh makes, I think, are extreme even within that cohort of judges. So in Al-Bahani, I mean, Bob mentioned, you know, the question in Al-Bahani, at least the one that went to the en banc court, was whether the 2001 authorization for the use of military force should be interpreted consistently with the laws of war when trying to figure out what the scope of the government's detention authority was. And what's remarkable about Judge Kavanaugh's opinion saying that the answer was no is that he wasn't writing on a blank slate, that in Hamdi, the only reason why the plurality opinion by Justice O'Connor, which Justice Kennedy joined, concluded that there was sufficient authority in the AUMF to justify the detention of a U.S. citizen and to thereby satisfy the Non-Detention Act, which requires congressional authorization for detention of U.S. citizens, was because Congress in the AUMF had necessarily incorporated traditional understandings of the laws of war. And so, you know, what I found remarkable about Al-Bahani was not just Judge Kavanaugh's hostility to the Charming Betsy canon and the idea that all things being equal, ambiguous statutory text should be interpreted consistent with our international treaty obligations, but that what he was really doing was flying in the face of Hamdi and the whole sort of predicate on which the government's detention authority, at least for U.S. citizens, had rested. Now, al-Bahani, it was a concurrence in the denial of rehearing en banc, but part of what happened was, other than Judge Kavanaugh and Judge Brown, who had been in the majority in the panel opinion, all seven of the other active judges signed this, you know, unusual joint statement saying we don't need to go en banc because the panel opinion's discussion of international law was dicta. So basically, you know, Judge Kavanaugh got, you know, overruled by his own colleagues on this point. But I actually think the more, you know, the more important, at least to national security law today, place where Judge Kavanaugh's hostility to international law has shown up has actually been in the military commissions, where he really has been the principal defender on the D.C. Circuit of the government's, I think, really important and really controversial legal position that the commissions can constitutionally try offenses that are not clearly recognized international war crimes. He wrote a concurring opinion to that effect when the en banc D.C. Circuit heard al-Bulul 1 in 2014. He wrote a four-judge concurrence to that effect in 2016 in al-Bulul 3. And what you see in both of those opinions is not just, as I think Jen rightly puts, the idea that courts should be reluctant to apply international law absent incorporation, but rather affirmative hostility to the idea that international law should apply even when it is incorporated. So, you know, in the context of military commissions, in 1942, and when the Supreme Court upheld the military commission trial of Nazi saboteurs, part of the sort of key holding of the majority opinion was the idea that there was no right to jury trial for enemy belligerents who commit offenses against the laws of war. It was baked into ex parte curin that the laws of war were a relevant, if not dispositive, part of the authority of military commissions. And, you know, to Judge Kavanaugh, that's no never mind, because how could it be that the international community could be in a position to say anything that would bind U.S. courts and that would constrain the jurisdiction of U.S. military tribunals? So, you know, I think folks may find his position more convincing than I do. I think what's interesting to me is there really is daylight between Judge Kavanaugh's view of international law and even what we might think of as the more sort of typical view of conservative judges when it comes to the interaction between domestic and international law, and that that really has consequences in the Guantanamo cases, where we're mostly dealing with these pretty, you know, generic, general, open-ended statutes. And so the most context we can find for some of the hard questions is indeed to be found from international law.
Now, Steve, I know there's one case at least where we saw Judge Kavanaugh, I believe this was Bulul 1, if I'm getting the numbers correctly, actually reach conclusion in part based on an analysis of international law where he found or I guess accepted a Supreme Court interpretation that a particular statute had actually incorporated the international laws of war into it and therefore did a sort of analysis of the customary international law to find whether material support for terrorism was within that. What do you take out of that? At least some people have pointed that to a case, at least where in certain cases, Judge Kavanaugh takes international law very seriously within the constraints that he sets forth, which is that where it's self-executing or where it's incorporated explicitly by reference in statute.
I mean, listen, I think Judge Kavanaugh is, you know, he's responsible, right? And so it's not like he is categorically hostile to international law in all cases. When he gets a case where, you know, any judge would have to concede that the relevant statutes are in fact incorporating international law, you know, he'll do his job as a judge. And I actually think his jurisprudence on political questions is really relevant in this respect because, you know, he strongly believes that cases involving interpretations of statutes, even those interfacing with international law, generally don't involve political questions, generally don't raise political questions. I mean, that's the whole, you know, that's the heart of his concurring opinion in the El Shifa en banc case from 2010. So, I think the point is just that when it really matters and, you know, there's at least some room for interpretive dispute, he just about always errs on the side of not looking to international law. And sometimes, as in al-Bahani, he ends up getting overruled by his colleagues. And sometimes, as in al-Bulul, you know, he ends up writing what's not the majority opinion, but that what really is, I think, the most important opinion for the military commissions, and one that I think is a little scary when you think about it. And we think about sort of if international law is not the relevant constraint for the jurisdiction of military commissions. What is? And how far can the government go to subject people it claims to be enemy combatants and unprivileged belligerents to military jurisdiction during wartime? So, you know, I'm not saying he's acting in a way that's like, you know, deeply, how do I say, unjudge-like. I just think it's really to the very far end of the spectrum when it comes to the relevance of international law in these kinds of national security disputes. I mean, I'm not aware of any other judge who's ever argued that as a categorical matter, the charming Betsy canon should not apply to use of force authorizations and declarations of war, an area of law where international law is actually especially salient. And I think that's a really telling reflection on exactly how he feels about this. And as Bob said, you know, in an area where I think there's no reason to think he will, he wasn't already perfectly comfortable as a circuit judge and wouldn't sort of follow the same path as a Supreme Court justice.
I think on the international law, I would characterize, again, his view totally differently. I mean, I think Steve is looking very much as, is it pro-international law or anti-international law? And, you know, Judge Kavanaugh, which is actually quite a mainstream conservative approach to interpreting the Constitution, instead would think, whose role is it to incorporate international law? And if it is such an important thing, where it's relevant and what role it plays in international affairs and national security, of course we would want the elected branches that we as the people have some semblance of say over, where there's power distributed among lots of players, not just nine people on a court, deciding to incorporate law. And so I think that's why it, in the Bahani case, you know, people may read the law and the text of the AUMF differently, but, you know, Judge Kavanaugh spent time in that opinion, you know, at least putting forward his interpretation of the relevant text and finding that he did not believe that it incorporated expressly the relevant international principle. And so, you know, you can disagree on that point of statutory interpretation, but I do think for him, it's very clear that it's not pro or con international law. It's who is supposed to be making that decision. And he's in his speeches and opinions talked repeatedly about that being Congress's role, even if it means Congress has sort of carte blanche or in a broad way incorporated international law and it's been expressed, then that's what the court is going to defer to and apply. And I think he's been pretty consistent with that in opinions, quite frankly, even when it might lead to an outcome that seems like it would be against perhaps policy preferences, like in the Hamdan case, where actually at the end of the day, Judge Kavanaugh wrote an opinion suggesting that the conviction should be vacated simply because, you know, under the ex post facto doctrine and the fact that material support for terrorism had not been an international offense at the time that it, and incorporated as such at the time that the offense was committed, that there was not a leg to stand on there because of the interplay between international law and what Congress had done in its various national security legislation.
That was actually the case I meant to refer to. I think I said Bellul earlier, but I meant to refer to Hamdan. Steve, go ahead.
I just want to say, I mean, I think al-Bahani is revealing of the daylight between Jen and myself here, because in al-Bahani, when Judge Kavanaugh is arguing that the charming Betsy canon should not apply to use of force authorizations, he's not saying we should defer to Congress. He's holding Congress to a clear statement rule, which no court had ever done before, which no judge had ever argued for before. And so I just, you know, you may think he's right. I mean, I don't begrudge folks who think he's right about that. But the suggestion that that's a mainstream view among conservative judges is, I think, lacking for evidence. And in al-Bahani, I mean, the reality is, you know, maybe I'm just an extremist in thinking that when it comes to individual rights, it's a little concerning to defer to the political branches when it comes to the relevance of international law, especially when the Supreme Court, in the only case on point, has specifically tied the constitutionality of the assertion of military jurisdiction to the violation of the international laws of war, and then spent 20 pages analyzing whether there was, in fact, a violation of the international laws of war. So, you know, folks can agree or disagree about whether this is a good thing or not. I just think that the notion that he's not an outlier in this space is belied by his record.
So I think it's important to also note his approach to Charming Betsy, which is, again, the position that you – whether you should read statutes in a way that they don't conflict with customary international law – is not limited to just the AUMF and the detention authority. In his 87-page opus about this, he's very clear that he would reject Charming Betsy principle writ large, except for a very small category of cases. And he speaks in very strong terms that the courts, federal courts, lack legitimate authority to apply international law without Congress expressly granting that or incorporating international law or law of nations into a statute. And he gives a number of examples where that happens, and I think that's what you're referring to, where Congress does put it in. He is a good judge. He will follow the directions of Congress, and he will not hesitate to apply the law of nations and international law where it applies. And we see in the habeas cases, he is taking – if it was just him, he would have never granted habeas rights in the Bemidji Inn case. But – Supreme Court did, and he has treated that very, you know, seriously. So he's not one like maybe a Judge Randolph, who is sort of unhappy with those cases being in the D.C. Circuit, maybe giving him short shrift. He has given them, you know, thorough treatment. But he has also made clear that, you know, as a matter of international law, that he thinks, absent a blinking red light from, you know, Congress that apply international law, that it is illegitimate for courts to do so. Is that hostility? You know, I think Jen's right. It's his view that it's appropriate for the political branches to the president to either himself take it on as a policy matter, international law, or for Congress to codify it. And that's certainly a legitimate, you know, view. But, you know, that is certainly a hostile, view of the role of international law, because there is a long tradition of it being viewed as federal common law. The Charming Betsy case goes back over 100 years. And as Steve said, he really had to work hard to try to distinguish the O'Connor opinion in Hamdi, basically saying, well, she did refer to international law, but it's only a one-way ratchet. It only gave, you know, informed what the power was, but it was never meant to limit it. That would have been an extreme, you know, unbelievable ruling, and we can't read that in. That's because that's how he thinks of things. He thinks it would have been an extreme ruling, so he won't read it in. But I think that's very telling of what he actually thinks about these things.
Now, there's a lot – we can dig a lot deeper into Bahani and a lot of these issues, but I want to move on to a few other things with the time we have left. Jen, let me turn to you a little bit, because I think you made the point – I made the points a few times now that for Judge Kavanaugh, this question of international law really comes back to the separation of powers, the roles of the political branches versus the courts. And of course, international law is just one aspect of that broader conversation. Another big one that comes up in the military commission's context that we've been discussing, another context is this question of war powers. This is a subject that Judge Kavanaugh has written about, actually more probably in his writings not as a judge, but in articles, including an article for Lawfare at the end of last year, reviewing David Barron's book on the subject. Give us a little sense of how does Judge Kavanaugh think about these war power issues? Where does it depart from, or how does it have a synergy with these international law issues we've been discussing?
Well, I think it does have a synergy with the international law issues, because my read of, you know, what he said about separation of powers and war powers is that, you know, both Congress and the executive have an appropriate role. And sometimes I think in the past, his or other conservatives' view has been described as, you know, very kind of disproportionately pro-executive. And so I think Judge Kavanaugh has written and said a lot that suggests that he actually does think Congress has quite a significant role in regulating military commissions and being involved in war powers in a way that, you know, sometimes that actually really puts him in the mainstream, and at times maybe differs from some other conservatives who have just more exclusively you know, maybe not seeing as much of a role for Congress.
Absolutely. Now, Bob, turning to you, I guess in the military commission's context, which I know where a lot of the cases that you worked on, the context in which they arose, how does these war powers view kind of play out in Judge Kavanaugh's jurisprudence and approach to these issues? Is it along the lines that kind of Jen described, or are there certain nuances we should be looking at that come out when they're actually applied, you know, when it hits the fan, if you will, in the military commission's context?
Well, I think he's a careful judge who's trying to make limited rulings, again, because I think he views the judiciary as having a very limited role in these contexts. And we saw, you know, in the Guantanamo cases as well, that when he approached those cases, he would, you know, dive in and carefully consider every one of the arguments, factual and legal, raised by the detainees, and really cross-examine all the arguments made by the government. But every time he would end up siding with the political branches, with the executive, or with Congress, and reading in limited role for the judiciary. And through his sort of careful approach of like actually digging into each thing and making specific rulings to, as to each, he has created rules both in the military commission and in the Guantanamo context, which are, you know, going to govern things moving forward. So in the Guantanamo cases, he approached, you know, every one of the little arguments. So if someone said, well, I was at a guest house that wasn't a Al-Qaeda guest house, it doesn't prove that I'm Al-Qaeda, he would say, let's deeply examine that. And then at the day, you end up with a rule with, if you're in an Al-Qaeda guest house or a Abu Zubaydah guest house, you are pretty much Al-Qaeda. So that sets a precedent going forward. And then he did the same thing for training camps. And he did the same thing for telling false cover stories and for several other things, which created the building blocks, which then resolved pretty much most of the pending detainee cases on their facts. So he's detailed, he's thorough, but he also, I think, has an agenda to set standards going forward, which will give guidance to the D.C. Circuit in future and to the executive branch.
And let's take it, of course, so far we've talked about military commissions, these big questions about national policy and kind of direct challenges to those. But of course, that's not the only context in which we see national security arise before courts or before Judge Kavanaugh. He's also had a number of notable rulings regarding civil litigation in the national security context, some related to the Alien Tort Statute, some related to kind of state tort claims against the government or Bivens actions against the government. Steve, I know you have written a great deal in this area and follow it really closely. What's your sense about how he's approached these kind of civil litigation national security contacts? And I know probably we need to break it up into a few different buckets, but I'll leave that to you to start the conversation.
Well, I mean, I think Judge Kavanaugh, I would say make two big points. That one, he's generally of the view that these cases actually are justiciable, right? That he's skeptical of broad and sort of unflinching application of the political question doctrine to categorically bar these suits. But at the same time, he's, you know, invariably hostile to reaching these claims on the merits, I think, because of Jen, you know, what Jen was saying before about his, you know, his deeply held view that it's not the job of the courts to sort of anticipate or step in to fill the gap that Congress has left in the space. And, you know, I think hopefully listeners know that Congress has actually been historically, you know, completely deficient at providing express statutory remedies for violations of federal rights by federal officers. And, you know, Judge Kavanaugh, I think, has been here not aggressively out of the mainstream in reinforcing that skepticism. Bob mentioned his concurring opinion in Mishal versus Higginbotham, where a divided D.C. Circuit panel refused to recognize a cause of action for the alleged torture of a U.S. citizen by the FBI while he was detained in Africa. He dissented in Doe versus ExxonMobil, an alien tort case, anticipating some of the arguments that I think the Supreme Court would later, you know, make in Kiobel and in Jesner. And, you know, I actually think one of the most revealing opinions, although it's not by him, it was joined by him, is Judge Silberman's opinion for the majority in a 2009 case called Saleh versus Titan Corporation. This was a state law tort suit against a private military contractor arising out of Abu Ghraib. Here, there's no federal law. There's just state tort law. But the majority, you know, relying, I think, somewhat controversially on what is itself a controversial 1988 decision by Justice Scalia called Boyle, thought that it was the job of the federal courts to affirmatively displace state tort law despite the absence of any express command from Congress, and to thereby preclude these torture suits from going forward, basically a sort of federal common law derivative contractor immunity. The Saleh panel wasn't the only panel to do this. We've seen decisions like that from two different panels in the Fourth Circuit, but it provoked a very unusual dissent from then Judge Garland, who, you know, I think Jen would agree, doesn't dissent very often. And, you know, I think it's a telling reflection that there are cases where, you know, there are sufficiently compelling policy concerns from Judge Kavanaugh's perspective that actually do militate in favor of the courts, you know, asserting themselves even if in that case it was in the other direction, to preclude otherwise available state law tort claims from going forward. You mentioned the 2012 panel that Judge Kavanaugh and I were on, and I think I'd asked him about this case at that panel, and he said, you know, it shouldn't be controversial that federal rather than state law should govern the tort liability of military contractors on the battlefield. And I said, no, I don't think it's controversial at all, but point me to the statute that says so. Right. So, again, you know, folks probably may have a hard time disagreeing with that decision, but I do think it's an interesting reflection on what he views of as the judicial role in these cases, which I think is not necessarily always to defer to the political branches, but I do think is relatively consistently skeptical of reaching the merits in cases where there's no constitutional imperative to do so. So contra, for example, the Guantanamo habeas litigation.
I think the Exxon case actually is telling about his deference to the executive and his discomfort in having the court reach into foreign affairs matters. You know, so there Exxon was being sued under the Alien Tort Statute, which provides jurisdiction to sue about violations of the law of nations, saying that Exxon had been complicit in Indonesia, working with the Indonesia army in the rape and murder of citizens there. So it's very serious charges, and the case was moving forward in the district court on just state law claims. And Judge Kavanaugh dissented there and said, allowing this to move forward was inconsistent with the bedrock principles of judicial restraint. So again, he speaks in very broad terms. And he picked up on some language from the Supreme Court SOSA decision about whether you should defer to the executive about whether allowing a lawsuit to move forward would be harmful and therefore the case should be dismissed. SOSA actually used very kind of weak tea language, you know, saying, well, there's a strong argument the court should give some weight to arguments by the executive branch that a case should be dismissed based on those kind of foreign affairs concerns. Well, Judge Kavanaugh took that as a license and a dictate to, in fact, do that. So it says if the executive branch writes us a declaration, which we think is reasonable, suggesting there'll be foreign affairs harms, as long as it's reasonably explained, he says, we must defer to the executive and have the case dismissed. So he said he would have granted mandamus and had those remaining state claims dismissed. So again, I think it's telling to how deferential he is to the executive branch and the political branches on matters of foreign affairs, even if that's not a national security case.
Well, I think on the Doe versus ExxonMobil litigation, and there may have been several different stages that litigation was before the D.C. Circuit, but I mean, towards the final stages, I mean, part of my read of what Judge Kavanaugh was relying on was interpreting the Alien Tort Statute and how that's supposed to interplay with these claims. And I think the facts of the case were that there were Indonesian citizens who had been really harassed and abused by Indonesian military members. And so the question was, could they sue ExxonMobil because it had not done a good enough job in sort of supervising the security role of the military folks there? And then at the end of the day, one of the conclusions Judge Kavanaugh reached was that under the Alien Tort Statute, that doesn't authorize a foreign suit against corporations, which, as it turns out, ends up then a few years later being an interpretation that the Supreme Court, affirms and says was the right understanding in Jesner.
Well, I think that's not true for domestic corporations.
Well, I thought the issue there was him. It was ExxonMobil, I thought, situated overseas based on behavior that was happening overseas. And it was
the Kiobel problem, not the Jesner problem. That's all I was trying to say.
Okay. Thank you. But anyway, so I think he's looking at how do we read the Alien Tort Statute? What kinds of suits does it authorize? And you would see the same kind of thread that we've talked about with some of the other cases where, some of what's going on again is him looking to see, is there express clear authorization for this kind of suit to be brought? And I think the other point that he raised is that sometimes in the past, courts had looked at the Alien Tort Statute and claims that folks are trying to bring under that, and what would be the parallel suit that you would bring if you were a U.S. citizen bringing suit there. And he made the point that similar suits would not be able to be brought by American citizens under the Torture Victims Protection Act. And so really the interpretation that was being asked for under the Alien Tort Statute would have been even more friendly towards, overseas claims than domestic claims, if you look at similar causes of action.
Now, finally, we have seen a lot of controversy, including on Lawfare in the last few weeks, about some writings that Judge Kavanaugh has done about the independent counsel, about the president's appointment power, and about how these things might bear on how he could rule in regards to various challenges to the Mueller investigation, whether it's to the special counsel's status, some of his actions, the president's ability to be investigated, things like that. Jen, let me turn to you. I mean, how do we see Judge Kavanaugh's views on these questions of, I guess, executive power and how the president can manage the executive branch playing out? And of course, there are issues that he's touched on, not only in this context, but also in a variety of cases about independent commissions and other bodies. Is there a unifying theme there that people should be pulling lessons from for things like the Mueller investigation, or is that really a bit of a red herring?
I think that what you're referring to is some of the things, obviously, that Judge Kavanaugh said in speeches about possibly the independent counsel statute or his view on Justice Scalia's dissent in Morrison. And a number of folks have pointed out that actually the independent counsel statute's lapsed. So I don't think that's directly relevant to Mueller. If we're looking at broad principles about Judge Kavanaugh and his view of the executive branch, I think sometimes, you know, people might look at the Morrison dissent as being just exclusively pro-executive. And I guess here again, I think coming from Judge Kavanaugh's perspective or more of a formalist constitutional perspective, it's not as much about how much power the executive holds in relation to the other branches on this point, but how much supervision the executive should have over what happens underneath the executive branch. And so in that area, I think Judge Kavanaugh does, I'm sure Bob and Steve would agree, many opinions that suggest that he thinks, you know, the executive needs to have much closer supervisory authority through appointments and removal over the independent commissions than it has currently. But if we're trying to also read tea leaves about, you know, his view on various dissents, he has explicitly spoken about the Morrison dissent. Interestingly, he also, in a speech within the last couple of years, lists three dissents by Justice Scalia that he thought would eventually become the law of the land. He didn't explicitly in that speech say whether he supports the dissents, but he listed Morrison. He listed actually the idea that he thought that our deference would probably cease to be an issue years down the line. And then he also talked about Justice Scalia's view in the Hamdi dissent. And he did not explicitly say his view on the dissent one way or the other, but he did say that his feeling is that it does shock the public in general to think that an American citizen can be detained indefinitely without formal charges being brought. So his anticipation was that one day, rather than being, you know, just Justice Scalia's dissent, that approach, which is very formalist on habeas corpus suspension, would become the law of the land, which I think might surprise people who might have him more in sort of a box, a pro-executive or pro-deference box.
I would say, I mean, I think before jumping to conclusions about Kavanaugh and Hamdi, I mean, I would suggest that folks read his 2011 majority decision in Omar versus McHugh, which was one of the cases the Supreme Court heard in 2008 as Munaf versus Guerin on remand, where over a pretty strongly worded opinion concurring in the judgment from Judge Griffith, you know, who's not exactly a bleeding heart on these issues, Judge Kavanaugh saw no problem with an act of Congress that he interpreted, I think somewhat controversially, to prevent a U.S. citizen from attacking his transfer to a foreign country on the ground that he feared torture if he was transferred to that country. So, you know, I think Omar, I think, doesn't get enough attention in sort of how much it reveals about where Judge Kavanaugh comes down in these cases, and if Congress is trying to cut the courts out of the loop, I'm not sure he would have the same lack of timidity that Justice Scalia had in this context. But on the broader point about Morrison, I published a post on Lawfare on Thursday afternoon that tried to actually disaggregate this whole fight over what Judge Kavanaugh's hostility to Morrison might mean for Mueller. I think the reality is that it actually is complicated because it boils down to whether you think that the principal objection to Morrison versus Olson is simply the existence of a for-cause removal protection for an inferior executive branch officer, which Special Counsel Mueller also has, or whether you think it's the myriad other problems with the independent counsel statute that Justice Scalia identified in his dissent that the special counsel regulation largely solved or otherwise ameliorated. And I think, you know, you can't tell from Judge Kavanaugh's speeches, from his opinions, for example, in the CFPB cases, which of those views he holds. But I think it's, you know, I think it's more than a non-concern. And if in fact the reality is that, no, it's not about four-clause removal, it's about all the other problems with the independent counsel statute, then presumably, you know, the legislation that would insulate Mueller from being removed without cause would also be constitutional in his view. So, you know, I think there's nuance here. I think there's important nuance here. And I think what's the most important point that I hope, you know, everyone comes away from this podcast with is, whether you agree with him or not, in almost all of these topics, with the possible exception of the Alien Tort Statute and Bivens, the views that Justice Kavanaugh, that a Justice Kavanaugh would hold on these issues are pretty significantly to the right of those of Justice Kennedy and will move the court pretty significantly to the right. And some of the listeners may think that's a feature and others might think it's a bug. It's a free country. But I think, you know, that to me is the what really comes through in his national security jurisprudence is how his philosophy produces results that look different, for better or for worse, from those that would obtain when Justice Kennedy was the median.
Well, I think that tees up well for what I'd like to make our kind of closing questions to you all. And Jen, I'm going to start with you. So we obviously, Justice Kennedy's departure is a major shift. Justice Kavanaugh stepping in, if he is confirmed, takes the court in a particular direction, although that's obviously not necessarily a sure thing at this stage. What do you see as Justice Kennedy's legacy as being in the national security space that we've been talking about today? And how does Judge Kavanaugh or future Justice Kavanaugh, if he does ascend to the Supreme Court, going to fit into that legacy and affect it?
Well, I think as we've been saying, you know, throughout the call, Justice Kennedy would have taken what we would describe as more of a functional approach, weighing various values and looking at the constitutional issues perhaps in a little bit more of a balancing kind of a way. And I do think it's correct to say that Judge Kavanaugh, at least in the opinions that we've seen him write on the D.C. Circuit, would, like the other justices who would be thought of as conservative, take a more formalist approach. Again, I think that's because he sees the separation of powers as really being the stronghold for individual rights, and that, you know, rights or system of government are most secure or most constitutionally grounded when the bulk of the decisions are being made by, at least in the national security and foreign policy context, by the branches, Congress and President, that we might think would be more equipped on the ground to be able to make those determinations. I don't know. So in that sense, I'd agree that it seems as though he would take more of a formalist approach. I think it's too early to say, and because we don't know the precise way the issues would be framed or how they'd come to the Supreme Court or exactly how everybody would weigh stare decisis concerns in all the cases. I think it's too early to say whether that would move the court right or left, but I do think it's fair to say that he holds separation of powers to be a very important value throughout really the entire constitutional system, and would be somebody we would think of as more expressly applying that or seeing that value in the decisions that he would reach were he to become a Justice Kavanaugh.
Bob, let me turn to you and direct you the same question about Justice Kennedy's legacy.
So I think you previously to Jen made the legacy regarding national security, and I don't think he has that significant a legacy there. You'd see the Boumediene case about habeas for Guantanamo. You'd see his trying to preserve a little bit of the Alien Tort Statute. I think both those things were written on shaky grounds, and a Guantanamo case was limited to Guantanamo, wasn't extended to Bagram, where there were far more detainees. We see that it hasn't impaired the power of the executive regarding transfer or other matters or provided any civil remedies. So it's been a very limited decision, and over time I think it's going to be one which is going to be sort of limited to one context and one affair, but we will see, you know, time will tell. I think whatever's left of the Alien Tort Statute after the most recent ruling about corporations, the touch and concern fuzziness that Kennedy tried to put on a gloss earlier in Kiobel will, I think, probably fade away as well, especially now with Kavanaugh being, I think, fairly hostile to the Alien Tort Statute. So I think the question will be the legacy about other issues like same-sex marriage and other things, where the question will be, what does Judge Kavanaugh think about stare decisis, about overruling past precedent, because I have very little doubt that if the same-sex marriage issue just came to Judge Kavanaugh the first instance, he wouldn't think that would be an appropriate issue for the judiciary to handle in the first instance and to legislate from the bench over. That would be his thought process. I'm pretty confident about that. And I think some of these other issues, too, which the court did, on abortion, too. I don't think he would have been a voter for Roe. But now that Roe and Casey, that's the law, does he treat that as binding precedent? Or is he willing to pair together with the other four conservatives and overrule those things? And I think that's the ultimate question which should worry and concern of the liberals and the country more as a whole, and which really we're not going to get any answer from any of these committee hearings. But I would say I think everyone on this podcast who knows Judge Kavanaugh thinks of him as a very smart judge, a very honest judge, a very thorough judge. You know, but he does have his own perspective on the law, and that's not hidden. And the question is, what's he going to do with that as far as respecting existing precedent? And that's an unknown.
And Steve, I'll turn to you for a closing word.
No, I mean, I think Bob puts his finger on it. I mean, I think the two things I think it's worth thinking about is, in the national security space specifically, imagine the world we would live in if the dissents in all the cases in which Justice Kennedy provided the crucial fifth vote for the majority had prevailed. So imagine if, for example, in Razul, I mean, I guess there were six votes in Razul, but in Hamdan, if the dissents had prevailed and the original military commissions had been allowed to go forward. In Boumediene, if the dissents had prevailed and there had been, you know, and the Supreme Court had upheld Congress's power to take away the habeas jurisdiction of the federal courts, even in those contexts. You know, it's a scary world to me where you'd have such a limited judicial role in these national security cases, at least where U.S. citizens weren't concerned. And I guess the last thing, looking forward, I mean, Bob's right to focus on some of the more hot-button social issues. I also think, I mean, for all of the discussion of just how careful Kavanaugh is about deferring to Congress and taking statutes seriously, imagine if in 10 or 15 years, Democrats control both houses of Congress and the White House and are pushing aggressive legislation through that actually runs into some of Judge Kavanaugh's ideological and constitutional commitments. I don't think he's going to be shy at all, as he hasn't been in the, you know, appointments clause and removal context, of not deferring to Congress and the executive branch in those contexts. And so, you know, I don't think it's right to portray him as someone who generally defers to the political branch. I think it's better to portray him as someone who defers when he thinks courts have less of a role to play, and national security is just about categorically an area where he thinks that's the appropriate way forward. And if that's going to be where the court is for the next 15, 20, 25 years, I think it puts a lot of pressure on the justice who I think would then become the median among the current court, and I think that's Chief Justice John Roberts, to try to sort of split the difference and not, you know, totally cut off a meaningful judicial role in the national security context. And that to me is going to be where, you know, the big fights are in the Supreme Court and national security litigation in the near future.
All right. Thank you all for joining me today.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't done so yet, please give us a rating and review wherever you found us, and share us with your friends and followers on Twitter and Facebook. The Lawfare podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.